Whether you drive a car,
need a car,
or just occasionally bum a ride with friends,
you've come to the right place.
Join Jill and Tom as they break down everything that's going on in the auto world.
New car reviews,
shopping tips,
driving green,
electric cars,
classic cars,
and plenty of great guests.
This is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast.
All right, this is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast. I'm Tom. Thank you for joining us today. When you have a moment, you know the drill. Check us out at Consumer Guide. I don't know why everyone doesn't just do that every day and then get every member of their family to do that every day. That would be handy. But check us out. New car reviews, fun used car stuff, great classic car stuff. And you can listen to the podcast right there on our homepage if you are so inclined, though we would really prefer if you subscribed. All right. Apparently, she didn't lose a limb. On the phone with us remote, because she claims she doesn't have a car, Jill Simonello, how are you?
I'm doing all right. And no, I did not lose a limb. I didn't even really I've got some odd bruises and on my arms and things like that. But other than that, I'm perfectly intact. I am not injured. And I had a really good rally.
So you were home from the Rebel rally, no injuries, any damage to the vehicle?
Yes-ish. So, Not anything catastrophic. I mean, my partner lives in Phoenix, and she drove from Needles, California, back to Phoenix, no problem. But we had a small sway bar issue, and I think they took it out. And then, oddly, she had just bought new shocks for the vehicle, and one of the shocks came apart while we were going over some of the rough terrain. But I have to give a huge shout out to the mechanics who are on the Rebel rally. They are, you know, just freaking amazing, because they were able to put the shock back together and take the sway bar out, and we were able to complete the rally without any further issues. And they work on trucks every day, all day, all night. They're very often up until 6 a.m. working on vehicles that get damaged during the rally. And they're amazing. And I mean, the terrain this year was really rough. There's been some rain and very harsh winds and things like that out in California that have just utterly wrought havoc upon the terrain. And there's a really good photo of us being stuck in a crevice because we thought we could go over it, but we could not, and we had to get winched out.
So quick question about the sway bar. Did it break, or what happened to the sway bar?
I feel like it was one of the control arms to the sway bar that broke. So I don't think they took the full sway bar out. They just took out the control arm.
For people who don't know, a sway bar is a really important part of on-road control, and it connects the left with the right side of the wheel. So is this the front axle?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was on the front.
But a sway bar can compromise articulation in off-road situations,
yes,
limiting how far up and down a wheel can go. So some vehicles will actually have automatic sway bars that you can disconnect from the cab,
yeah,
to allow that to happen. All right, so you're back. Does your partner have all her limbs?
She does, in fact, have all of her limbs, and we still like each other after 8 days of spending, I guess I should say, after 80 hours in a car together.
That's crazy, because I'm done with you after an hour of the podcast.
No, you're not. You're stuck with me, and you like me.
Yeah.
Yeah. But no, I mean, it was a lot of fun. It was challenging. This year was, I think, probably, it was the 10th anniversary. It was the most difficult year ever.
Oh.
And, we had anywhere between 20 and, I would say, 25 checkpoints every day. So longitude and latitude checkpoints that we had to plot on a map and then go find using a map. So no cell phones, no GPS, no anything in the car to help you find where you're going. And you're using magnifying glasses, and I often would use a magnifying glass on top of a magnifying glass to try and see where the paths were going on a topographical map. And it's really cool. It's a lot of fun. You meet some amazing people. You get to see some stunning scenery. I just posted, so I carry with me what I call my magical unicorn camera, and it's a crappy kid's camera that has no zoom, because you can't have zoom on cameras for the rally, because they don't want you to cheat. And I take the magical unicorn camera, and I just posted 60 or 70 photos to my personal Facebook page that kind of show some of the conditions and the beauty of the terrain that we were covering. We got sheeped one day, literally surrounded by hundreds of sheep. So that photo is on
there.
That's
never happened to me.
It's an experience. I'll be honest with you. And we're just like, what do we do here? And we're like, I guess we don't move. We wait until the sheep pass. There's another great photo of the truck. It was like a double rainbow day in the morning as we were getting started. And I managed to capture a photo of the truck with the rainbow ending in the bed of the truck.
Oh.
So, yeah, I mean, they're not the greatest quality photos, but I think they capture the moment. So it was a lot of fun. It was really challenging. And I learned a lot of things about myself, and I learned a lot of things like new skills. So it was all around successful.
Well, there you go. Welcome back. Glad you have all your limbs. Randy and I had different limbs in the pool. He had left leg. I had nostril.
I went off the board. I did blow my nose a lot because my allergies were in high gear, but I did keep my nose.
All right.
I kept my nose.
Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
So much news while you were gone. So much news.
Yeah.
An interesting story. Now, we're going to talk later in the show to Stephanie Brindley. She's the Associate Director of Research and Analysis, S&P Global. And like our good friend Sam Fiorani, she gets quoted a lot. But very respected analyst in the industry. We'll be talking about big news from Stellantis. Stellantis talking about a $13 billion with a B dollar investment in North American manufacturing. Whenever you hear those numbers, you know, lots of grains of salt, because a lot of that stuff may have been announced already. They were going to do it, but they package it for news. But still, $13 billion is $13 billion. And there's this crazy, crazy factory shuffle happening, which is going to make people in the Chicago area very happy and people in Canada very unhappy. So we will talk about that with Stephanie. Interesting news from Toyota. It's a little bit scattered and not very detailed, but Toyota's been building a car in Japan called the Century. This is a large luxury sedan only sold in Japan, usually for the emperor to ride around in, but it's a big sedan, sometimes powered by a V8, sometimes by a V12, but a cool looking thing, kind of coveted by Americans. And I think a couple have been gray marketed to the U.S. over the years. In fact, I know that I've seen some. But Century is about to become a Toyota luxury brand positioned above Lexus. Now, we don't know a lot about this, but Lexus is quite successful, especially successful in the U.S. And if you're thinking about like where this would fit, would Toyota want to position this between Lexus and Bentley, for example? Bentley being kind of high-endy, but not as high-end as Rolls-Royce. Or do they want to go full-on Bentley? The thing about Bentley is Bentley's kind of sporty. So the positioning of this is interesting. There's nothing sporty about the Century, right? It's like the world's finest Buick is kind of where that thing is positioned. So we'll see where that goes. Interesting story, but a couple of years ago, Toyota did add an SUV to the Century brand. So they did expand that a little bit, but again, they were only selling them in Japan.
Yeah. So. I've been looking at pictures and I'm just like, it's a cross between, to me, like a Chrysler 300 and a Rolls Royce.
Yeah, it's a little old school, and there's some sort of classic 80s American look to it too. And I really like the composite, old school composite headlights that aren't fully integrated. It's kind of a cool look. I'm excited to see what this is all about, but we'll see. Toyota takes quality so seriously that, you know, they don't want to roll out a new brand in any hurry. So they may announce this now, and we may not see squat for 5 years.
Fair point. What I find really interesting, too, is, you know, we have Hyundai, who launched their luxury brand Genesis, and it's hard to believe that that's been more than 5 years at this point. And like their vehicles are doing amazingly well. And so their rollout was very fast. So I'm curious to see if Toyota takes a page out of the Genesis book or how they handle it.
Yeah, and Genesis's early launch, the first few years, was badly botched by a bunch of things. They just had two cars when the world was moving to crossovers, the G80 and the G90, neither of which was interesting. The G90 was based on the Hyundai Equis. The G80 was based on the Hyundai Genesis. So there's some naming confusion. And then the G90 Genesis was only available through dedicated Genesis stores, whereas the G80 could be sold everywhere. It was super confusing. Dealers were mad. Dealers were told they needed franchises or they didn't need franchises. And it took forever for them to get a crossover out. But when they did, dang.
Yeah.
Dang. And I drove here in a Genesis. I drove the GV70 3.5T, and I forgot what they call the top trim level. Is it Prestige? But what a delightful car. And speaking of Bentley, with a Bentley-like interior.
Yeah,
Genesis is on fire.
Do you have the one with the orange seatbelts?
I do.
I love that.
Yeah, it's insane. Yeah, and then we're waiting for a performance car from Genesis. They're under the Magma sub-brand, and a big crossover called GV90.
Yep.
So we'll see when we get those soon. You will have a review to talk about. We're going to talk about the Volkswagen GTI in a moment. But I need to talk to you about something that confounded me, and you're like an interiors control person.
Yes.
I recently drove the Ford Expedition Tremor. And Tremor's, okay. Tremor's the new off-roady sub-brand, but that's not the thing here. The thing here...
I know what the thing is.
The thing here, and they really shouldn't do this to old people like me. The steering wheel is remarkably clean and free of controls.
Yes.
And there's just...
Except
on both sides of the spokes, it's like a two-spoke steering wheel, more or less. I think there's a bottom spoke, but who cares? But on either side, thumb access is what appears to be an iPod-style control. Mm-hmm. If you remember the original Apple iPod, no markings, no words, just a circle with a circle in the middle of it. Like a concentric ring around a circle, and you just had to stroke that, move it, slide it, or press it. And all I wanted to do was adjust the steering wheel. There are no external steering wheel controls. So you have to press this thing in, and it turns out it's the right controller, and then move your hand around the ring, and slowly the functions appear. And then you press there or the center to activate those functions. And in this case, you just get four arrows. And it is delightfully simple once you know how to do it. Maybe a couple more steps than you would if there was actually a physical control. But the lack of physical controls does leave the interior very clean and the steering wheel looking very clean. So I guess I abide. But it took me forever to figure this out. And there was no way I was going online or checking an owner's manual. I had to figure this out for myself.
You were not going to RTFM?
I was not. So question for you.
Yeah.
You've seen these controls. Have you used these controls?
Yeah. So have you driven the new Lincoln Navigator yet?
I have. Fabulous vehicle.
These controls are very similar to the ones you see on the Lincoln Navigator, but the Lincoln Navigator has steering wheel, side mirror, and the pedal controls all through that thumb wheel. Whereas the Ford Explorer has the side mirror and steering wheel, the pedal and steering wheel controls only through the thumb wheel. And they retained the physical controls for the side mirror adjustments. And when I asked them why they did that, the reason that they said was because Ford Expedition owners are going to tow more than the Lincoln Navigator owners, and they will need to adjust their side mirrors more frequently. And so having the physical controls on the door just made more sense for that vehicle specifically. And
interesting. So they do acknowledge that there's an extra step there.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. And I will say as we are moving to a much more tech forward integration in vehicles, there are some things that are not ideal, like adjusting, I believe Polestar, Rivian, Tesla, they all have you adjust your side mirrors and your steering wheel through the center screen.
Right.
And if you're not fast enough, the screen disappears in the middle of your adjustments or whatever. And you're just like, now I have to go back and redo this again. And so, to me, that is less than ideal. And so I think this is an interesting solution that makes it tech forward, makes it, the interior look clean, but still gives you a quote unquote physical control to be able to maneuver. So it's kind of an in-between thing. And I definitely think it's something an owner would get used to, but you're right. There are no markings. And if you don't know, you don't know.
Yeah. And I think too, if you're not a journalist who hops around, you know, I get into a different car every week, sometimes two cars, and I have to do this stuff more often than anyone else would, than most other people would.
Right.
So for me, it's an annoyance. But once you've set this thing, you know, and especially if you set it to memory, you know, in case your wife is dwarfish like mine, then you never have to deal with it. So it's not a big deal anyway.
You, a dude, will never have to deal with it again because you wear the same shoes with the same sole every day. But women might find it a little bit more annoying if they wear high heels, tennis shoes, you know, Converse shoes, platform shoes. That will get a little bit more annoying.
Uggs.
It's not a set it and forget it.
Uggs. Moccasins.
Uh-huh. I wear Croc slippers a lot during the rally.
Rope sole sandals.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Enough of that. Enough of my belly aching. Volkswagen GTI. You recently drove the Volkswagen GTI. Was it the car?
The Golf R.
I'm sorry. Yes. Oh, actually a different vehicle. I just drove the GTI. You drove the Golf R. Okay.
Yes.
So explain the difference.
So the Golf R is more performance, more expensive, more like sinister looking. It's got more, you know, more stuff. You know, the new Golf R got a little bit of a refresh for this year. It has 328 horsepower, 295 pound-feet of torque, which is an increase of 13 horsepower over the 2024 model. So it's in 2025. And, you know, you've got a bigger infotainment screen this year, 10.25 inches, ambient lighting, digital cockpit. So behind the wheel gauges are all digital. And I don't know. So the Golf R is one of those vehicles. So my husband and I used to have a GTI. We loved the GTI. And I really like the Golf R. I think it handles really well. You know, I personally am not a fan of any kind of an automatic transmission, even though this one is really good. But there is no manual transmission for the 2025 model year, which breaks my heart a little bit.
For the Golf R, there is for the GTI.
Is there? I didn't think there was.
Oh, I thought there still was.
No, I think the GTI also did away with the manual transmission.
I stand corrected. The one I drove was an auto.
Yeah, so if you want a manual transmission in either of these vehicles, you're going to have to go back to the 2024 model year. There may be some still available that are new, quote-unquote new, but probably not.
Probably not.
Yeah. But overall, I thought this was a fun vehicle, easy to drive in the city, really fast and peppy on the highway. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I mean, one thing I don't understand is you have a Golf R, which is, in essence, a performance vehicle. And it always irks me when you have a performance vehicle and they put auto stop start on it, because that is for fuel economy savings. And I'm like, whoever is buying this car doesn't necessarily, they're not buying it for fuel
economy. No, the buyer doesn't care, but Volkswagen does. They got to get their own numbers up. And you do still end up stuck in traffic where it actually ends up working and making a difference. I get it, but I don't know.
It creates lag.
So how often when you were driving it aggressively, like having fun with it, did the stop start kick in?
Well, I mean, it didn't kick in when you were driving aggressively.
Yeah.
But like as soon as you're stuck in stop and go traffic on Chicago highways, which is like every time you drive, you stop, the engine shuts off. Then you put your foot on the gas and then it starts back up again. And it's like, you know, and I'm just like, come on. And
what,
I mean, yeah,
what
you
was
can
that
turn
noise?
It off.
What was that noise?
Yeah.
That noise.
You could turn it off, but it's just annoying that there's no default to turn it off and keep it off.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. I guess it's out of character for the car, but ultimately, I don't know if it impacts the driving experience that much. And it's saving you some gas, and it's saving Volkswagen some numbers.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm still unconvinced that it actually saves anybody gas in real world driving. I think it saves gas in a vacuum, like when you're stopped at a 2-minute railroad crossing. But I'm unconvinced in stop and go traffic that it makes any kind of a difference.
The numbers are there. I mean, the EPA believes that they do. And I remember...
Of course they do.
I remember our good friend Nick Kappa at RAM. He's not with RAM anymore. He's further up the ladder at Stellantis, fully explaining the impact on the RAM pickup trucks, including the RAM Hemi. And the savings at just a stoplight were actually relatively significant, according to him.
Of course. Of course.
I'm not suggesting I don't believe Nick. I do. I just haven't seen the
numbers.
He has
to say these things.
Yeah.
Yes. He has to say these things.
I'm inclined to believe it matters.
Yeah. But no, I mean, overall, I love this vehicle. I mean, the infotainment system is a lot. And, you know, everything is through the infotainment screen. The one thing that really irked me the most about the infotainment screen is there is no button or, hot button to turn your cameras on. Like, you have to have your vehicle in reverse to put your cameras on. So there's no way to just turn the cameras on.
I do appreciate that capability a great deal. Sometimes I have to park cars. My driveway situation is complicated with my neighbors, and I don't pull cars in until late in the evening. And I'm often backing up against a curb, and I really, really, really don't want to scratch the wheels. So I have to go past the curb and back up to engage the camera in a lot of vehicles.
Yeah, and so I wish, and it was funny because when I got the Taos, same situation, and I actually emailed Volkswagen. They're like, oh, if you have any questions, let me know. And I'm like, oh, I do have a question. I'm like, is there a way to get a hot button for the camera on the top nav for the infotainment system? And they're like, no. And they look, you know, I got the sense they're like, why would you want such a thing? And I'm like, I just, you know, I want it. I want
Germans.
To be able to hit that.
Germans.
And especially if, you know, if you're in a vehicle that is, that has the around view camera. I think the Golf R only had the backup camera, but if you're in a vehicle that has the around view camera, being able to hit that button and just seeing immediately what's going on around your vehicle without having to put it into gear is super helpful. Like if there's toys in front of the vehicle, behind the vehicle, you know, if there's anything going on from the curb to, you know, another vehicle, you don't have to put the gear, you know, the vehicle in gear in order to see, I want the hot button. So that's the end of that story. But I mean, overall, I think the infotainment system, again, it's something an owner would get used to. As you pointed out earlier, you and I are in and out of these vehicles, like all these vehicles, different brands, different manufacturers, different setups, you know, every week. And so it just can get a little bit much to go from one vehicle to another. And we don't always have time to read the manual.
No, we got to take a break here. But real quick, people should know that the Golf R and the GTI are the only Golfs available in the U.S. for 2025. And I think that was true in 2024. The Golf is basically gone from the U.S. And then the Golf R is pricey. What did yours cost?
It had some special packages on it. So I believe it was more than $50,000.
Yeah.
Base price is $47,000.
That's a bunch of money.
Yeah.
That's a bunch of money. Yeah. I love driving that car. I think I like the GTI more. It just feels a little lighter and more flingable, even though it's a lot slower. But yeah, the really delightful vehicles to drive. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we speak to Stephanie Brinkley, Associate Director of Research and Analysis at S&P Global. Stick around.
Questions or comments?
Drop us a line at carstuff@consumerguide.com.
That's carstuff@consumerguide.com. Welcome back to the Car Stuff Podcast.
And we're back. This is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast. I'm Tom. She is Jill. Jill is remote today. Jill, how you doing?
I'm tired. I'm really tired. That's how I'm doing.
You have a lot of news to catch up on.
I know. Well, you know what's really funny is I asked ChatGPT for the important, you know, news things that happened since October 8th, which is essentially when I went offline, and it like did a really bad job of giving me a summary.
I've been very disappointed lately with Grok. I've been looking up stuff when I'm writing car reviews, and I see stuff that I know is wrong. And I'm like, are you sure? I actually type, are you sure? And he goes, and Grok responds, let me check. And it's like, sorry. And then it comes up with the right stuff. I'm like, what the hell? So much for AI. AI is not making the difference it should. But as we noted earlier, Stellantis made a big announcement investing $13 billion in U.S. infrastructure. They're calling it the largest investment in Chrysler brand history. And there's a lot there to unpack. And it seems like new CEO Antonio Filosa is anxious to make some news, and this is part of that. To make sense of this all, on the phone, Stephanie Brindley, Associate Director of Research and Analysis at S&P Global. Stephanie, how are you?
Good. How are you guys doing?
I'm not going to speak for Jill. I'm dandy.
I'm tired.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah, I imagine you're tired. You've probably been covering the story we're talking about nonstop now for a couple of days.
Oh, that was not too bad. You know, I get some tariff stuff shaking up the weekend. All good with Stellantis investing the money. The Stellantis investment was a pretty big announcement and moved around some production expectations that we had had before.
Yeah. Stephanie, real quick, tell us about S&P Global and what you do there.
Sure. I'm with S&P Global Mobility, our automotive arm. And, you know, we look at the industry. We look at production and forecast and registration and sales, all kinds of data, and try to help our clients and help the world understand, you know, what's next, what's happening, and how to make better decisions within your business.
Now, this big announcement that came from Stellantis, largest investment, and as people have noted, probably a lot of this investment was known and it's discussed before, but it's being packaged for media consumption. But $13 billion is $13 billion. That seems significant. But attached to it is some really big factory news. News that's going to make people in Illinois very happy and people in Canada really upset.
Yeah, that's a good summary, right? So we have the Jeep Compass was expected to be produced in Brampton, Canada, and will now be in Belvedere. And that again, to your point, that was an investment that was known, but it shifts plans, and I think it shifted amounts a little bit. And FCM Stellantis is, you know, says they still want another product to go into Brampton, and they're looking into figuring out what that's precisely going to be. We have a high tariff situation that is affecting the decision making. It is affecting the process, but we have to wait to see what's coming into Brampton. Their intent is to have something go in there.
Now, Brampton most recently was building the old LX cars, right? The Chrysler 300, the Dodge Charger, the Dodge Challenger. And when those vehicles became electric, they moved production, am I correct, to Windsor, Canada?
They did. Yes, they did.
So Brampton is idle.
Brampton is idle. And like I said, the intention was to have it idle for a while and put the Compass in there, and that's been changed to Belvedere, and we just don't know what product is going into Brampton instead.
And then the Belvedere story is interesting because for a long time it seemed as if Stellantis had promised the UAW they were going to build a truck there, probably a mid-sized truck, and then at some point it was going to be electric, I think, or something like that. But now it's building the Compass, which came from Mexico, if I'm correct, and the all-new Cherokee, which could be an exciting new vehicle. Is how many jobs is that, and does this meet the promise that Stellantis made the UAW?
Yes, it should meet what they expected to give the UAW. They're saying around 3,300 jobs for Belvedere. And Compass is interesting because it's moving up from Toluca to some degree, but the new Compass is already in production in Europe, and that's actually what we'll get.
Oh,
it's a new generation of Compass.
Okay, so we're getting Compasses now, or we'll be getting them from Italy?
No. We're not getting them from Europe. We're still getting them from Mexico. But the version of Compass that we see will be the all new Compass, not the same vehicle that's produced in Toluca.
Okay, exactly the same. So there's no update or anything like that.
No, not exactly the same. We're getting the new Compass. We're not getting the old Compass.
And if I read the tea leaves right, the pickup truck is Stellantis is going ahead with a new mid-sized pickup truck under the Ram brand, and they're moving that production theoretically from Belvedere, that never happened, to Toledo. Is that correct?
That is correct. That is correct. So there's some shifting around of where they want to build things, but at least for the UAW agreement, they are fulfilling their contract. That's another element with Brampton, though, because there was a commitment to Unifor to build a new product in Brampton. So they do still have a commitment to Canada to work through.
When we say commitment, what does that mean, and how much of that is enforceable?
That's a good question. it's enforceable to a degree, but most contracts will also have, you know, sort of market conditions clauses in there. And it's enforceable to a degree, but to the point that it's completely not profitable, there's ways to move around it. And you do have new contract negotiations coming up, I think, at the end of this year or next year. We have new contract negotiations. So they're pretty solid for the most part, but there are occasions when sometimes things have to change. And when these contracts were negotiated, no one was expecting that you would have a 25% tariff
right.
on non-USMCA compliant vehicles out of Canada.
Yeah, that's the craziness. So moving over to Windsor, Windsor now builds the minivans, the Pacifica and the Voyager, and the electric versions of the old muscle cars. That plant's still kind of underutilized, right?
It is. We would expect to see another Chrysler product in there down the road, and also the internal combustion engine versions of the Charger have started production. So we should see a little bit of a pickup in volume with the ICE versions of those cars as well.
And then back to Brampton for just a second. What are the odds that Brampton ends up shuttered?
I don't put those odds. I'll let them tell us when that's going to happen. No, I really can't tell you.
All right. And then what do we know then, if they're moving the pickup truck that was originally going to go to Belvedere, to Toledo, what does that tell us about that truck?
That's a good question. I'm not sure how much we can read into it. This is one of the things that I was asking them. I'm like, okay, so does that mean it's going to be, you know, on the next-gen Wrangler? And there could be some more similarities there, but it's not clear yet. That was a product that was sort of earmarked for Belvedere, but it's very well possible that the what they thought the platform might be 3 or 4 years ago might be different. So we might see a little bit of a product expectation and an evolution as to what that would be. Building a midsize pickup truck profitably is not a simple process.
Yeah,
it really is not, especially when they don't really have one. If you look at Nissan, if you look at General Motors and Ford, they are leveraging an international pickup truck that they have. And Stellantis currently does not have a body-on-frame international midsize pickup truck to be able to start to work from.
Yeah, my thinking, Stephanie, and let me know what you think, is that if, in fact, they're moving the pickup to Toledo, then it's probably going to be very similar to the Jeep Gladiator. And that puts them at a serious price disadvantage, I think, with the rest of the field. Gladiator's pretty expensive, almost too expensive for that segment. And I don't know how much less expensive they can build a Ram.
That we'll wait and see kind of how that evolves and whether or not it wouldn't be exactly the current Gladiator, because we are talking about 2028 and we are talking about product platform changes now and then. And they know what pricing issues they have to deal with, and they know that they're not likely. Jeep does get a little bit of a premium for being a Jeep.
Right.
And that Ram may not be able to live up to, right? So Ram pricing is not going to be the same as Jeep pricing. They're not going to have a midsize truck from Ram from Jeep that are identical pricing.
Mm. Interesting. Interesting, too. They'll have to compete with each other. So what other stories are you following this week?
Oh, we've been looking at it again. You know, I said some more tariff news is happening. The medium heavy-duty commercial vehicle tariff has got a little bit more information on that this weekend. There's the opportunity for a little bit of a reduction in steel and aluminum tariffs, depending on when you build it, where you build, and how much commitment there is to increasing U.S. steel and aluminum production. And an offset that automakers can use has been extended. So a little bit of news on that front.
I was surprised to learn that the big truck market, the medium duty and big truck market, was as big as it is. But I heard a number, correct me if I'm wrong, of $25 billion annually.
I would have to double check that particular number. I usually think about units.
Yeah. Well, what kind of unit volume do we see there?
Yeah, I know, right? You're going to say that. Dang, I didn't look that up. Like, wait a minute, that's the number I should have, but it's not my head right now. I'll flip that one up.
That's fine. But one of the interesting things I learned about this, and I don't know a lot about big trucks, but I didn't realize that Volvo, for instance, owned Mack. I guess I knew that at some point, but I forgot. But that those vehicles are built almost entirely in America.
Yeah, Volvo is interesting. It is not the Volvo that you know is a passenger car
right.
company. It is a completely separate company, completely independent of the Volvo passenger car that is part of Geely. Completely different companies. And yes, they own Mack and several other brands.
And then the big volume player there, I think, is Freightliner, right? What is that, Daimler Trucks North America? And
Freightliner is one, and Paccar is also a significant player in this room.
And they've got some exposure to the tariffs.
They do, especially Freightliner International has some exposure to the tariffs as well, with Mexico production. And some of the vehicles that they produce in Mexico, they have the ability to produce them in the U.S., but some of the product lines right now are currently all Mexico. And so you might see some shifting around in that and looking to figure out how that plays out. And, of course, with medium-heavy trucks, similar to light-duty vehicles, that the tariff applies to, if it's a USMCA-compliant vehicle, which we think most of these are,
uh-huh.
it applies 25% to the non-US content of the vehicle. So it gets pretty messy pretty quickly.
Now, I don't know the answer to this question at all. It just popped into my head, so forgive me. But the engine in these vehicles, very, very, very expensive. Are those built domestically, or are those coming from Canada or Mexico?
There's a mix. There's a mix of those. Some are from Mexico, and some are from Canada, and some are from the U.S. It's mixed yeah. everywhere. Ford has Canadian engine production, I believe, for one. And so, yeah, we do have a mix of, you know, the even for medium heavy duty, the North American supply chain has evolved over between 30 and 50 years. And I say that we had 30 years of NAFTA, and we had another 20 years before that of Canada and U.S. agreement. So this ecosystem was built over an incredibly long period of time, and everyone is exposed.
Well, now that you've mentioned the ecosystem, I have a really theoretical question for you. But right now we're in the middle of one administration, or early in one administration. Assuming that the administration changes in 3.5 years, 3 years, how easy would it be to rebuild and go back to what we had, and would we want to do that?
It depends on how much has really changed. There's been a lot of careful movement and trying to understand what the tariffs are going to be and how long they're going to be. It depends on how much change happens. And right now we've seen relatively small amounts of change in terms of actual production announcements. Like the Stellantis conversation we were just having, mm-hmm. they still expect to build something from Brampton. But they did move Compass up from Toluca, or from intending to bring it from Canada back to the U.S. We've looked at Toyota, I think, is moving around some RAV4 production, or they have RAV4 production in Canada and the U.S., so they'll look at where they source from for U.S. market versus Canadian market. We've seen elements like that shift, but we haven't seen a wholesale shift yet.
It's interesting you say that.
And it takes a few years to do that. Even if you look at GM moving some Blazer and Equinox ICE production up to U.S.,
mm-hmm.
that's not going to happen until late 2027. Just because it takes time.
It's interesting you say that, just because it feels like so much is changing. And this still from the, I'm kind of outside the production. I don't know much about manufacturing. It just feels like this announcement from Stellantis is huge. But you're saying it's not that big a deal.
No, no. I'm saying there isn't that much change necessarily. I mean,
okay.
You look at the plan for Cherokee was always Cherokee to come from Belvedere. That was the plan when they announced they're bringing the Cherokee back. And they're moving the truck to Ohio. Yeah, they're moving the truck to Ohio. So that isn't moving either Cherokee or the truck outside of Mexico or Canada.
Uh-huh.
Do you follow? The only sourcing change from one country to another really is the Compass going to Belvedere instead of being in Brampton. But Cherokee, when they said they were bringing it back, was coming up to Belvedere, and the truck got moved within the United States, not outside of the United States.
I got you. Stephanie, I'm so glad we have you.
It is an important investment, but it's a little bit more fluid.
Well, I'm glad we spoke to you, because you brought a lot of clarity to all this. Thank you. Stephanie, how can we keep track of what you're doing and what's going on at S&P Global Mobility?
SPGlobal.com, and we have a section on that website that has our automotive insights, and we always have constant constant flow of new information there.
Awesome. Stephanie, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
All right. That was Stephanie Brindley. She's the Associate Director of Research and Analysis at S&P Global Mobility. We're going to take a break and come back and... Jill?
Yeah, I never know when that's right. Because I'm remote, I don't know when to cut in. It's quiz time.
It's quiz time. Stick around.
Questions or comments?
Drop us a line at carstuff@consumerguide.com.
That's carstuff@consumerguide.com.
Hi, it's Brendan from Sons of Speed. You've heard me and my colleague Paul on the Car Stuff podcast whenever Jill's out of town. But now you can hear us every week on the We Are Motor Driven podcast, along with Jennifer from Auto Exotica and Harvey from Rides and Drives. We talk about everything from sports cars to trucks to EVs and our favorite, speed. So join us each week by searching We Are Motor Driven wherever you get your favorite podcast.
Welcome back to the Car Stuff Podcast.
And we're back. This is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast. I'm Tom and she is Jill. Jill, how are you?
Still tired. And I do have to say, I should point out, like, because I'm remote, it is really hard to, like, interrupt.
Yeah, so sorry about that. Yeah, we should have been on screen or something because, yeah, I couldn't see her raise a finger or anything. My bad.
That's okay. You had a lot to say and a lot of questions, and I thought they were all good.
No, I love this, and Stephanie knows all this stuff, so it was great. I was just talking to producer Randy during the break. Stephanie is quoted nearly as much as Sam, our good friend Sam Fiorani, in the industry publications, so she knows her stuff.
Yeah, she does. Well, you know, I feel like while I was gone on Rebel, she was actually in Chicago and did a presentation during the Mama Spring or Fall Rally or something, but she was here giving a presentation to media about automotive stuff.
Oh yeah, was she at Chicago Drives Electric?
Maybe that was it. But
yeah,
she, yeah,
yeah.
And I was like, oh, sorry to miss.
I've met Stephanie. It's been a long time though, but yeah, she's sharp. All right, it's quiz time. But first, why don't we talk a little bit about your social media?
Okay. Yes, you can find me at Jill Simonello. So first and last name mushed together. And I have the hashtag car du jour. So on any social medium that you're on, if you're looking for me and you can't spell my name because it is a lot of I's and L's, you just type in car du jour, like soup du jour, and you should be able to find me that way. But TikTok, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, all the things, I'm there.
You know what's crazy? Just a crazy coincidence. First and last name mushed together is my Charles Schwab password.
Good to know. Where are your capitals?
I don't want to give that away. All right, you haven't had a quiz in 2 weeks, 3 weeks.
I will say, I listened to last week's episode, and I got all of the grand versus grand, but I did not. I would have thought pumpkin was not the deodorant. Like, who wants pumpkin deodorant?
I don't know.
I'm with y'all.
I am super interested in the revitalization and rebirth of Old Spice. They took a dead brand, right? They just took a dead brand and like, this brand's dead. Why don't we run with it?
Yeah. You know? I mean, the commercials are hilarious.
They are. And that's something you do. It's a name that people recognize, but they don't take seriously. So you've got free reign to do whatever you want to with it. And their marketers have. They went goofy.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Speaking of goofy, you know who is goofy?
You.
David Dunbar Buick.
Okay.
He wasn't goofy at all. But he's the founder of Buick. Buick was founded in 1899, became a part of General Motors in 1908. And this is all leading up to something. Are you ready?
Okay.
Was it a Buick?
Okay.
I'm going to give you a real model name. You have to tell me if that was ever a Buick.
Okay.
Super easy.
Super duper easy.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Number one, we've got the music. We're ready to go. No okay. long pauses. Wildcat.
Yes.
That's it? No conversation? No head scratching?
No.
No. Yeah, it was. Yeah. It was a concept car in 1953, and it was an actual model between 62 and 70. And it was kind of like the big car version of the Riviera. It was just a big coupe with a big engine. Good looking thing.
It came back as a concept recently as well.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah, and that's actually...
I didn't answer to that, and I had no commentary.
Yeah, there was an electric coupe concept, really interesting looking, and I thought that they were going to run with that in China, but they never did. Buick, yeah, of course, is big in China.
Essentially, what they called that is a design concept, and so what they did is they pulled pieces of it, like pieces of the grill that you see in current vehicles. The new emblem that is like 3D was debuted on the Wildcat. And so like you'll see pieces of the vehicle that are show up in actual production vehicles, but not the vehicle itself.
I blame the demise of coupes and sedans for the lack of concept cars we see now. Concept crossovers aren't that interesting.
Yeah.
You know, there's just, there are design limitations there. All right, you have one. You're on the board. Nice job. Five questions total plus the bonus question. You need three total for a win. Number two, Centurion. Was there a Buick Centurion?
There was something that was called a Centurion, but the question is, was it a Buick?
All of these are real model names. Long pause.
I know. But the music. I mean,
the music helps.
The
music helps. Yeah, it's not dead air.
Get into the rhythm. You know what? I'm going to say yes.
Yes, correct. You've got two. You're in a good way. It's slotted between the LeBaron and the Electra between 1971 and 73. And it was, I read that it replaced the Wildcat. I'm not entirely sure that's true. But anyway, yes, you're on the board with two.
Woo-hoo.
All right, number three. Are you ready?
I am ready.
LaSalle. Was there a Buick LaSalle?
There was a LeSabre.
Darn tootin' there was.
That was like my dad's company car forever.
That was the volume Buick for a lot of years.
I'm going to say no.
Nope, LaSalle was a Cadillac.
Okay.
Not actually Cadillac. I don't know how much you know about the General Motors companion brands. But during different periods in, it was like the 30s and 40s, each General Motors division had a companion brand that was sold alongside. Oldsmobile had Viking, Buick had Marquette, Cadillac had LaSalle, Chevy didn't have one, and I'm trying to remember what Pontiac's was. It's not coming to me right now, but Pontiac was actually the replacement, the companion brand that replaced the original brand. So anyway, yeah, LaSalle between 1929 and 1940, beautiful sporty cars, always based on the smaller Cadillacs available at the time, and kind of helped Cadillac get through the Depression.
Okay.
Yeah, good stuff. All right, you have three. Oh my gosh, you're going for a sweep. All right,
so we should,
won.
You know, just end now.
Yes, we
on
should.
A high note.
All right, that's the end of the show. I got nothing else anyway, so yeah, we're done.
Well, you know.
Satellite. Was there a Buick Satellite?
I'm going to say no.
Nope, there was a Plymouth Satellite, and I can bring up Adam 12 now, but for a couple of years, the lads on Adam 12 were driving a Plymouth Satellite. 1965 to 1974, member of the Plymouth line, usually as a mid-sized car. All right, you've got four. Real tough one for you now. You ready?
All right.
Riviera.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep.
You had, I feel like you even mentioned it already on the show.
You had to get that one. What's that?
Yeah, I feel like you already mentioned the Buick Riviera already on the show today.
Today?
Yeah.
Today? Oh, yeah. The Riviera, and more or less its marketing companion, the Oldsmobile Toronado, I love those cars. But they were kind of the founders of the personal luxury movement. Now, that was very premium in those days. These were very expensive cars. But cars like the Monte Carlo, the Grand Prix, the Cordoba kind of owned their heritage to that. The Riviera was available between 1963 and 1999. I think there were no brakes in that. Personal luxury car. So there you go. You've got 5 out of 5.
Ooh.
All right. You've been talking nonstop about wanting to go to Bahrain.
Totally. Totally nonstop.
And you know what they have in Bahrain?
What do they have in Bahrain?
McDonald's.
Okay. I'd be surprised if they didn't. But all right.
All right. I need you to tell me how many McDonald's there are in the world. You should know this by now.
I don't. 100,000.
You're not terribly wrong. 41,800. How many in the U.S.?
20,000.
Close, 13.7. And then finally, how many in Bahrain? How many McDonald's outlets do you think there are in Bahrain? Here's a clue. They're all owned by the same franchisee.
5.
34.
Okay.
But you're ballpark, right? You're there.
Totally ballpark.
Yeah, well, it's not like there's 7,000. All right. That's I need you to tell me. I think you know the drill here. Which of the following menu items not found in Bahrain McDonald's? Are you ready?
I am so ready.
Yeah, you've been waiting for this. The Big Tasty.
So.
The Big Tasty. The Chicken Mac. The Chicken Make. The Chicken Mac Arabia. Or the Crunchy Cheddar Dog.
Okay, you were giggling over the fourth one or the third one?
Third one.
Chicken
Mac Arabia.
Yeah, I think it's got to be that.
That's the fake?
Yeah.
I don't want you to read too much into my giggling.
I know.
Are you sticking with that?
I'm sticking with it.
Yeah, that's real.
Oh, wow.
It makes me laugh just because it's a pita, the Mac Arabia. They talk about Arabic bread in the menu. Like, I'm reading this, like, what? And, yeah, it's just pita. It's a chicken pita.
Okay.
Yeah, chicken garlic sauce pita. The crunchy cheddar dog, that's fake. The chicken mac is what you think it is. And the big tasty is like a quarter pounder with something called tasty sauce.
Oh, it's probably the super secret spy sauce from McDonald's.
I don't know.
Which is like Thousand Island dressing.
Yeah, they just call it tasty sauce.
Hmm.
I'm reminded now that I haven't had lunch.
I had Chipotle for lunch today.
Yeah. So, just really interesting. I wanted to talk a little bit about Belvedere because that plant's been idle for a long time. And, and the Cherokee, right, the old version of the Cherokee, the Jeep Cherokee, sold well for a while, like over 100,000 units. It was pretty popular, but it was kind of disappointing. And just stop me when you disagree, but it was supposed to be midsize. But it always looked small, and to me it never looked bigger than the Compass, which is a compact car, and it didn't really fill the gap, in my opinion, between the Compass and the Grand Cherokee. The Grand Cherokee's always had sort of a luxury thing going on, and it's been much more expensive. Also, it's usually been pretty nice. So the Cherokee, I think, lost its way. They discontinued it, and now they've got a new one coming back that's a little bit bigger. I think it looks good. And I'm interested in this for a bunch of reasons. The Compass doesn't sell especially well, so the Cherokee needs to sell well to make this Belvedere thing work. That's a big factory, and I think it had like an annual capacity of like 350,000 units, maybe more with three shifts. So big, high-volume factory, and they've got two vehicles that are middle volume, unless you think the Cherokee's going to sell well, and I'm throwing it to you. Is the Cherokee going to sell well?
Well, I mean, I think it's going to depend on a lot of factors. You know, how are they going to price it? And hopefully they'll be able to price it better and competitively since they've brought production, you know, into the United States. And, you know, what features and how, you know, what engine, what powertrain, what, you know, I think there's just so many factors that it's going to depend on. I think it has the potential to sell well. You know, that segment is doing really well. You know, it's not compact and it's not, you know, full on midsize. And so I think that it has the potential to do well. I mean, the by virtue of the segment that it's in, but you know, the other thing that people are going to be looking for is reliability. And in yeah. some ways, you know, Stellantis has had a real problem with some reliability, though they haven't had near the number of recalls that Ford has had this year. But I think pricing, reliability, and features are going to make a big difference on whether or not it will sell.
You said something interesting I wanted to get back to, and you said it's not quite compact, it's not quite midsize. I actually think that's the problem with the vehicle.
Mm. Okay.
I mean, I don't know. Like the RAV4, the most popular vehicle, like, you know, on God's green earth, certainly it is the most popular vehicle in the U.S. It's a compact crossover that I think presents as a little bit large. So clearly there's some market for that because RAV4 is super hot, right? And it's about to get super hotter because there's a new one coming, what, in a couple of weeks, right? a couple months. But I don't know if that's the segment. I mean, one of the interesting things they've done with this, and we'll have to get a picture and post it on the our Facebook page, it is more boxy now. It's a little more squared off, and I think it has a sense of mass to it and maybe a sense of Jeep to it too. And I don't know that the Compass does. And they got rid of the Renegade, the little Renegade that I never thought looked that much like a Jeep.
I thought it looked like a Jeep.
Did you?
Yeah.
Because the Renegade, the Compass, and the Cherokee come from an era when I think Jeep thought they could sell anything they put the Jeep badge on. And that stuff was even kind of premium priced, which is a little ridiculous. And they went through some price adjustments at some point, which is a certain amount of market capitulation. I don't know how customers read that. But ultimately, now they've got the Compass, and Compass is pretty nice, and it's got more power now. And then we got the Cherokee coming in, and that's going to be a hybrid first, so that's good, right?
Yeah.
People love the hybrids these days, but we'll see. I don't know. I think it's a big deal, but I think that plant's going to need a little bit more stuff to keep that thing running. They want to bring 3,300 workers back. I think at its max capacity, about 5,000 people work there. But still, 3,300, that's good news for Illinois.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I'll be curious to see. I mean, I could see them bringing a third product into that plant. And I think that shuffling the midsize truck over to the same plant that builds the Gladiator makes sense from a product standpoint, because you're building a similar vehicle, which perhaps a similar platform in the same plant. And so dividing midsize trucks wasn't going to make sense to me. And I feel like Ram has really missed out by not having a midsize truck, because the midsize truck segment has in the last couple of years exploded. So I think they're a little bit behind the game. Hopefully the midsize truck segment will still be strong in 2028 when this vehicle is supposed to be coming out. But yeah, I agree with you. This needs to sell well. There needs to be more production coming, and I wouldn't be surprised if they don't somehow put a third product in there, whatever that may be.
I am reminded, and I don't want to be the doomsday guy, but I am reminded of the fact that the Dodge Nitro, which was a compact crossover, it wasn't a crossover, it was an SUV, it was based on the Jeep Liberty, and right. That was kind of a disaster. Terrible
yes.
Mileage, odd use of space, really high step-in for a vehicle that wasn't good off-road. Nothing about the Nitro was good. We don't want to see that again, but that vehicle was really cynical. That was some nastiness. All right, guess what we did?
We had really good conversations.
We did, yeah.
We went through an hour.
Yeah, that was good. All right. Big thanks to Stephanie Brindley, Associate Director of Research and Analysis at S&P Global. Thank you, Jill, for phoning this one in. Thank you to producer Randy. I have an idea. Let's talk more about cars again.
Next week.
Remember to check us out at consumerguide.com.
The Car Stuff Podcast is produced by J-Turn Media.
To advertise on the show, please drop us a line at carstuff@consumerguide.com.